So, Jacob, this story has been told for so many years, you would think there's nothing left to learn, but you're saying that's not the case.
A lot of people don't realize that the book Eight Men Out, which is how most of us first learned of the Black Sox scandal story, was written back in 1963. And we've learned a lot of new information in the ensuing half century about the 1919 World Series. And a lot of the new information that we've uncovered has changed our knowledge of the Black Sox scandal and its aftermath and the legacy of the fixing of the World Series. And so all of these new pieces to the puzzle have helped provide definitive answers to some old mysteries and debunk some of the old myths. And the Black Sox scandal continues to be a relevant part of the sports world in the 21st century, especially as Major League Baseball begins to open its doors to legalize sports betting 100 years later. So we're still learning more every day about what happened in the 1919 World Series.
Well, the key theme of this story, and certainly it was laid out in Eight Men Out, was that the White Sox of 1919, a great talented team, was on the take, tied in with gamblers, and that was because they were woefully underpaid. You've discovered some new information on that.
Yes, this is kind of the central thesis of Eight Men Out, that the White Sox players were the most talented, but they were paid like the worst players. And that couldn't be further from the truth. We can't climb into the heads of the Black Sox players to know exactly why they threw the World Series. But we have accurate salary information that sheds a little bit of new light on how much they were paid, and we can compare that to other players around the major leagues. And it turns out that the 1919 White Sox were one of the highest paid teams in baseball, and most of their players were paid far better than their peers in the American League. And so we're able to kind of find, you know, more information about, you know, what may have been going through their minds as they were fixing the World Series. And, you know, if the White Sox players did feel resentment at their salaries under the reserve clause system, so did players from every other major league team. And so the scandal was a lot more complex than disgruntled players trying to get back at the big bad boss.
And the reserve clause basically prevented them from negotiating for salaries with other teams. They couldn't be free agents like we see today.
That's correct. You only had one team to negotiate with, and the owner of the team could offer you a contract, and you had to take it or leave it. So the White Sox players were under the control of Charles Comiskey, and salaries were depressed up until the 1970s when the reserve clause was out of effect. But before then, the players did not have a whole lot of leverage in terms of negotiating for salaries.
You mentioned Charles Comiskey. Of course, he was the owner of the White Sox at the time, and also the namesake for Comiskey Park, which was around for many years. There is a classic scene in Eight Men Out that I recall where Eddie Seacott, the pitcher, was trying to negotiate, complaining that he should have gotten a bonus, that he was sort of maneuvered out of this bonus that he should have received from Charles Comiskey, and Comiskey plays hardball with him and refuses to give it.
How many games does Mr. Seacott win for us this year?
29, sir.
You had Kid bench me for 2 whole weeks in August. I missed 5 starts.
We had to rest your arm for the series.
I would have won at least 2 of those games. You knew that.
I have to keep the best interests of the club in mind, Eddie.
I think you owe me that bonus.
29 is not 30, Eddie.
So this kind of dramatic scene in Eight Men Out when Eddie Seacott tries to collect a $10,000 bonus that he says was promised to him for winning 30 games, that story is completely fictional. No bonus was promised, and certainly not one that would have doubled the pitcher's salary in 1919. Charles Comiskey did promise a few other bonuses, but they were much smaller, around $500 to some of his players. And so the idea that he would have promised a bonus as large as $10,000 to any of his players is pretty ridiculous. And also, you know, we've dug into the box scores and the game information for Eddie Seacott, and it turns out that he did have a chance to win his 30th game in 1919. He just didn't pitch well enough. He got yanked in a game in late September after allowing 5 runs in 7 innings, and the White Sox rallied to clinch the pennant that year. And that would have been Eddie Seacott's 30th win. So by then, the fix was already in motion, and Eddie Seacott had already agreed to join the fix. So the idea that this was the reason that he joined the fix is totally false, and we can back that up.
We hear people talk about how dare they gamble away the World Series. How could they have done that? But gambling on baseball at the time was pretty common, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to understand the Black Sox scandal without understanding just how pervasive gambling was in the baseball world in the early 20th century. This was an era when gamblers gathered openly in every major league ballpark and bet on anything involved in the game. Gamblers would bet on the next pitch, strike or a ball. They would bet on what the batter did, whether he would make a hit or an out. This was something that was going on all the time. And so baseball players and gamblers had a lot of opportunities to associate and to make friends with each other and get to know each other and soon to collaborate with each other. Some of them would work together to provide, the ballplayers would provide gamblers with some crucial information that would help them in their betting that day. And so this is kind of how the culture was in baseball. And baseball officials didn't do anything to slow this down. In fact, they implicitly encouraged the betting activity in the grandstands because, you know, as long as the gamblers were paying money to buy a ticket to get into the ballpark, they didn't really care how much betting was going on during the game. And so there were a lot of attempts at corruption and game fixing in the early 20th century before the 1919 World Series. The idea that the 1919 World Series was this loss of innocence for baseball really, you know, doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
I'm talking with Jacob Pomerinke. He is with SABR, which is the Society for American Baseball Research. He's the director of editorial content for the organization. He also chairs SABR's Black Sox Scandal Research Committee, which is out with some new information. Jacob, why don't you tell us about some of the other research that's been uncovered, what you've actually called in an article, Eight Myths Out About the Black Sox.
Yes, so SABR just published an online project in which we're debunking some of the common misconceptions about the Black Sox scandal 100 years after the 1919 World Series. This is a story that continues to fascinate baseball fans a century later, and we're able to find a lot of new information. We've got some documents available at the Chicago History Museum, at the National Baseball Hall of Fame, in which we're able to piece together a little bit more of the story than Elliot Asenoff had access to when he wrote Eight Men Out back in 1963. And so we're able to find more information and put together more pieces of the puzzle that way. And one of the interesting myths that we found in digging up the Black Sox scandal story is on the alleged assassin who was hired by one of the gamblers to threaten the White Sox pitcher Lefty Williams before the final game of the 1919 World Series. And the we know now that this hitman character, who was called Harry F. in the book Eight Men Out, that this hitman was entirely fictional. He was created from the imagination of the author Elliot Asenoff for copyright reasons. And there's little evidence that Lefty Williams was ever threatened, but this is one of the most dramatic scenes in the movie Eight Men Out and in the book. But we know now, and Elliot Asenoff admitted later in life, that he had invented this fictional character. So this is one of many of the misconceptions about how the Black Sox scandal occurred and what really happened in 1919.
One of the other things that I think has always been taken as fact is that the players went sort of underground after this occurred. You didn't hear from them much. They just faded from public view because they were ashamed of what had occurred. That also isn't entirely accurate.
No, it's not. And, you know, when Elliot Asenoff went to interview some of the surviving Black Sox players when he was researching the book, what became the book Eight Men Out, he encountered a lot of resistance from the ball players. They didn't really want to talk to him. Happy Felch was his main source among the players as far as the Black Sox who would be interviewed by him for the book. But none of the other players who were alive would talk to him much. And Asenoff attributed their reluctance to talk to kind of the shame that they all felt about the 1919 World Series. This was a subject that he said nobody really wanted to talk about. And that actually wasn't true. And we've discovered, thanks to the power of the internet, more than 100 interviews among participants in the 1919 World Series, both the White Sox and the Reds players. And so it shows that a lot of people were willing to talk about this, the World Series. Those interviews just weren't very easy for Elliot Asenoff to find in 1963. Thanks to the power of the internet, we're able to dig up a lot of these small-town newspapers, which have been digitized and are available for researchers online. And so we've been able to find a lot of information from the players that they did talk to people. And this wasn't something where they hung their heads in shame about the World Series. This was just something that happened, and you know, some of them regretted and had some remorse for what they had done, and they just kind of moved on with their lives.
Buck Weaver was one of those that was kicked out of the game, one of the eight men out. Among those that have seen a lot of support through the years, long after his death, those who feel he was wrongly lumped in with the others. Shoeless Joe Jackson has become almost mythic in books and movies. Many think he was given a raw deal with his banishment from baseball. Has your research turned up anything to help or hurt those causes?
You know, Buck Weaver and Shoeless Joe Jackson have a lot of support and a lot of sympathy, because the truth about the Black Sox scandal is there were a lot of different degrees of guilt among the people involved. And Buck Weaver, for sure, had a much lesser degree of guilt than, say, his teammates Eddie Seacott and Chick Gandel, two of the instigators of the fix. Buck Weaver did not take any money, any bribes from gamblers, and by all accounts, he played his best during the World Series on the field. So a lot of people have sympathy for Buck Weaver and say that a lifetime banishment was a very harsh punishment for someone with his degree of guilt. You know, we haven't really turned up a lot of information that can confirm or deny his involvement. We have known all along that he attended some of the meetings discussing the fix before the World Series, and by some accounts, he was an active participant in those discussions. But nobody said that he ever took any money from gamblers or played anything less than his best. So he has a lot of support among fans and his surviving family members to try to get his name cleared. And, you know, the punishment among the players was pretty harsh. And Judge Landis came in as the baseball commissioner and in one fell swoop banned them all for life from playing professional baseball again. And you could argue that, you know, this was a little bit of an unjust punishment because, you know, players today would have a lot more recourse to appeal that punishment. The players union is strong, and they would have some legal remedies available to them that they did not have available to them in 1919. So you can argue that the punishment was harsh based on the degrees of their guilt. What you can't argue is that the punishment to ban these players for life was ineffective, because baseball had many problems with gambling and game fixing before the 1919 World Series, and after Judge Landis banned the Black Sox, these problems almost entirely went away. And so the idea was for Judge Landis to come in and clean up baseball, and he was able to do so, and that was largely through his punishment of the Black Sox. You know, if he could punish someone like Buck Weaver, who no one admitted ever took a bribe or played anything less than his best on the field, if he could punish Buck Weaver for life, then he could punish anyone for associating with gamblers. And so he was able to clean up baseball through his punishment of the Black Sox, and especially with Buck Weaver.
What do you hope that people take away from this new research?
Well, you know, I hope people understand that the story is a lot more complex than sometimes we find in books and on film. I think the you know, like many areas of history, there's a lot of compelling aspects, and the truth is just as dramatic as some of the fictional elements that we've all grown up believing. And you know, again, this is a story that continues to have relevance in 2019. You know, as sports betting becomes more and more legalized and more pervasive around the game, you know, there are a lot of lessons that baseball and sports fans can learn from the Black Sox scandal. And as we learn more about what happened back in 1919, you know, we can apply some of those lessons to 2019 too.